Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The U.S. slams the brakes on the United Nations Yemen ceasefire resolution. At the end of October, it was being reported that the United States and Britain, Saudi Arabia's biggest arms suppliers, were stepping up their pressure for a ceasefire in the Yemen war, what the UN and other organizations refer to as the world's worst man-made human disaster. The calls for a halt to the conflict came from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, his British counterpart Jeremy Hunt, and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. All of this as criticism of Saudi Arabia surged over its bombing campaign in Yemen and the murder and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Now it is being reported that the U.S. has slammed the brakes on a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for a limited ceasefire and increased humanitarian aid in Yemen over concerns about angering Saudi Arabia. So what's really going on here and why? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. She is editor-in-chief at Inside Arabia, Elizabeth Myers. As always, welcome back to our studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you were here about a month ago, and we were discussing this great breakthrough. Secretary of State Pompeo, Jeremy Hunt, Jim Mattis, they're all calling for a ceasefire and humanitarian aid. We were really looking forward to something very, very positive happening in a very short order. Now this, what's going on?
I think it's all related to the, as you mentioned, the Khashoggi incident, because the ties between what Saudi Arabia is doing with respect to Yemen and the ties with our U.S. support of that are too many integrated facets, really, for, I think, the U.S. to have a real way to pull out of that conflict without having some difficulties with Saudi Arabia. And in addition, my own personal view of this is that there are ties between our president and Saudi Arabia that are as yet to be discovered. And when you have a situation that you have both the personal business, the state business, the UN, you have all of these things coming together, you have a situation that makes the basically unable to pull out of something that's been going on now for 3 years, 4 years.
That's very interesting, because one would think with the unfortunate murder of Jamal Khashoggi that the United States would have incredible leverage over MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and be able to say, now, look, son, how nasty do you want this to get? There are some things that need to happen here as it relates to Yemen. We need you to be a little more reasonable. And if you can show us some flexibility on this thing, then, you know, we can find some ways to take some pressure off of you on the Khashoggi issue. But maybe to your point, there's more to this than meets the eye, because to me, that would be, especially for the guy who's the deal maker, what's he call himself? The great negotiator. That one to me would be pretty simple.
I would think so too. And I think that really highlights the distinction between the presidency and the Congress, because the Congress clearly is making moves to extricate the U.S. from its support of this effective genocide, really a nation side that's going on. There will be a vote, by the looks, later this week on ending U.S. support for the refueling of the war, of the airplanes, et cetera. But I think that's a real difference when you have the presidency is going one direction and the Congress is clearly indicating that the country needs to go a different direction.
It was reported earlier this month that Mohammed bin Salman got very, very upset, threw a fit, is the report, when presented with an early draft of the UN document, and that his response is what led to a delay and further discussions among the Western allies on this matter. And the reference to the Western allies, to me, I can understand, not agree with, but I can understand Trump's position if there are other relationships and other issues that aren't coming to light. But where's everybody else on this? And is he ignoring them, or is no one else putting pressure here?
We're living in a very strange era that we've never seen a presidency where the president does not take advice of his advisors and basically cozies up to our adversaries at the expense of our closest allies in the world. I think this is something that we really haven't seen before, and it's something that's not going to stop, apparently.
Because it even seems as though as soon as, or as early as this past weekend, the Saudis escalated their attacks in Yemen.
And they had promised to do that, and there was maybe some indication they would hold off a little bit on Hodeidah because of the situation there being the primary port where the humanitarian aid needs to come in. But they're on a trajectory of their own, and unless there is serious U.S. pressure to pull back, I don't see that they're going to do that.
It's been reported that Argentina is investigating Mohammed bin Salman for involvement in war crimes in what the New York Times is describing as the most significant test yet of MBS's ability to move past this international uproar. Argentina getting involved here is an interesting development.
I would say so, and it seems to come out of left field.
So where do you really see, because the reports were also that the UN resolution was not nearly as broad as most outlets were originally reporting. It was originally thought that this was going to be a ceasefire across the board, that representatives of the Saudis and representatives of those in Yemen were going to meet. But then these drafts started coming out, and it seemed as though that the UN draft was much more limited to ceasefire in Hodeidah, for example, and that the ability to provide humanitarian aid was not nearly as widespread as many had hoped, that the suffering was going to continue except in very limited areas.
I think that's the problem endemic when you're dealing with the UN in general. You're always going to end up with the lowest common denominator that you can possibly get through. Although in the face of this, as you put it, world's worst humanitarian crisis, which is the UN Secretary General's own words, one would think that one could get a better result, because there's not a lot to be gained by continued bombing and airstrikes. We know, according to the article that you sent me earlier today, there more than 16,000 airstrikes have destroyed all kinds of things: infrastructure, roads, schools, hospitals. There's really not a lot to be gained. Even historical sites, Yemen is one of the oldest civilizations on this earth, and they have buildings and architecture and mosques and religious sites going back millennia. And I just don't see that there's much to be gained by continued destruction of this, except for the fact that there are so many parties involved. It's not just a matter of the Houthis versus the internationally recognized government. It's a more complex resolution. But with the UN process, one would hope that given the destruction that's already occurred, with maybe we're up to maybe 14 million people on the verge of starvation right now, mainly because of the blockade, not allowing humanitarian relief and food and medicine to get in, one would think that the parties voting would be able to come to something higher than they've come to.
I'm, how can I say this, shocked but not surprised that the mainstream American media has not taken up the mantle here, that Yemen is not on the front page of the news, particularly when you look at MSNBC, when you look at CNN, and you look at the positions that they're taking, the contrary positions that they're taking to the president. One would think that they would use this as an opportunity to force his hand or to at least expose the inconsistencies and the hypocrisies in the Trump administration position as it relates towards Yemen. I know that your organization, Inside Arabia, you all took out had a campaign during the United Nations meetings in September. And so talk a little bit about that. Talk about the success that was a result of that campaign. But again, I just find it interesting that you can turn on your television, especially now that the brakes are being put on what many thought would be a ceasefire, that the Rachel Maddows of the world would be all over this thing.
Yeah, one would think. Well, we tried very hard back in September while the UN 73rd session was in session in Manhattan by putting out creatives that highlighted the destruction that was going on with respect to the people. Airstrikes on school buses, the blockade of the port, the numbers of deaths of civilians by airstrikes. And while that, I think it was quite effective over 2 weeks to have New Yorkers and the officials attending the UN to be bombarded at every bus stop by a big tour bus or a mobile billboard with these images, stark, beautiful, but tragic images. And there seemed to be somewhat of a pickup thereafter with the media. But it's almost as if there's something else, you know, that can constantly trump that, if you will, and something that deflects from this. But it is a serious situation that has ramifications, not just beyond the country in which it's occurring. There are ramifications for what happens if the war continues, what happens when the war stops and there's no transition, there's no government to fill that gap. Then it becomes a hotbed for, you know,
now
radicalism.
Now we're dealing with Libya.
So there's every incentive to stop it now while before the crisis gets even worse, which is inevitable.
It is also very interesting to me to follow up on my point about mainstream media, how so many people have no clue about what's going on there. And I remember a couple of weeks ago when Michelle Obama was launching her book tour, and she made the comment about Donald Trump and how he had put her children in jeopardy by the comments he had made and how angry she was and how she would never forgive him. And I remember saying to people, well, she's right. What he did is unforgivable. But the first thing that came to my mind when she talked about her children were the children in Yemen that were blown up in the bus as a result of her husband's policies in terms of allowing the war to begin, green lighting the war, and providing support for the Saudis as in, boy, did people come after me? Did people come after me for saying that? Just how dare I draw any type of equivalency between the two?
But you're not here to be PC or politically correct. You're here to draw the comparisons that need to be drawn to show the hypocrisies that are out there that need to be shown. And that's important. And that's what we try to do also at Inside Arabia. We also just launched over the past two Sundays, and it will run a couple more Sundays, an ad campaign using the same creatives down in Florida, in Jacksonville. With I think it's a Florida Times Union newspaper, which the city down there refused some Emirati money for a project recently on the basis of what they're doing in Yemen, and we were just so pleased to see something like that happen that we said, all right, well, let's raise awareness down there as well.
And what type of response are you getting? Do you see that as these creatives get public attention, as people start to see these visuals, that it spurs interest and people start questioning what is all this about, and that you actually start to get some positive response?
Well, I think when we do these things, we do notice a an upwards blip on our the monitoring that we do of our website.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there is a direct response. You know, they look at the creatives and they're very dramatic and they say, who's doing this? What's the, and they think, of course, you know, maybe we're government funded or we're anti-Saudi or no, we're pro the truth and we want people to know the truth. And so that's what we try and do.
So what do you see going forward here? What are the options?
The options are the U.S. just has to do the right thing. And I think that with the new Congress coming in the House in January, we will see some more movement, even more than what's going on in Congress on both the Senate side and the House, to extricate the U.S. from supporting basically an unjust and devastating war that has no good end in sight.
One of the things that Citizen Trump ran on was that very point. I'm going to get America out of these senseless wars. One of the things that Senator Obama ran on. No more senseless wars. I'm going to get America out of these senseless wars. And I think what people, the disconnect is that it's one thing for what they say as a candidate, but a lot of people don't really understand they are functionaries of the United States government. And that when they get into office, there are factors, there are pressures, whether it's General Dynamics or Raytheon Corporation or General Electric and, all of those folks who are involved in the military-industrial complex. There are so many billions of dollars at play here. Very, very powerful lobbies. The lobby was the only thing they had to be concerned about. They'd be lucky. So just your thoughts on the pressures and that how the American people, what the American people need to do to bring pressure, real pressure, to counter those lobbies.
Well, it gets back to the grassroots level and there were some grassroots efforts, I think today and yesterday in New York, U.S. congressmen in New York, with protests outside their offices.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a matter of awareness. It's a matter of putting your dollars where your mouth is. And it's a matter of consciousness and conscience. And beyond that, it goes one person at a time.
Dr. Cesar Chalala wrote a piece in Counterpunch today. The war in Yemen is not a war. It's a massacre. And he opens by saying, the numbers are mind-blowing. Since the beginning of the conflict in Yemen, an estimated 85,000 children under five may have died from extreme hunger and disease, according to the last analysis by Save the Children, the International Health and Human Rights Organization. Although children are the most affected by the conflict, 14 million people are at risk. That was the number you gave earlier. 14 million people are at risk of famine, according to data compiled by the United Nations. Talk about the famine, because the famine is man-made as well.
Yeah, and I would also add that children, yes, are very much affected, but imagine also that pregnancies don't stop during war.
Mm.
Women's health continues to be needing assistance, to be needing medicine, to be needing food. How can you have a child if you're starving?
Kidney dialysis doesn't stop.
Exactly.
Cancer treatment doesn't stop.
All of those things don't stop.
Right.
So there, I think perhaps even, and then there's also sexual violence that happens with this as well as a technique of war.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a byproduct. It's a deliberate, intentional infliction of the way to absolutely dash people's morale and make them incapacitated.
It is terrorism.
Men and women.
It is terrorism. And it's being supported by the United States,
yeah,
and its Western allies. Elizabeth Myers, Editor-in-Chief at Inside Arabia, as always, thank you so much for coming in today. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. Look forward to having you back.
My great pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All
right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Three American military personnel killed today in a roadside bombing in Afghanistan. They were killed in Afghanistan's eastern Ghazni province, and this is the deadliest incident for U.S. troops this year. Three other U.S. service members and American contractor were also wounded when the IED detonated near the provincial capital. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack. Why is the United States still in Afghanistan? Who are we fighting and why? How much is this costing us? Well, for answers to these questions and others, we're going to turn to my next guest. He's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He served as analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from 1999 to 2003. He's currently director for Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. Dr. Weinbaum, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Yes, hello there.
How are you, sir?
Well, thank you.
Thank you. So, Citizen Trump told us that the war was a waste of money and American lives. Citizen Trump told us that the United States should get out of Afghanistan more than a dozen times, and we're still there. What's going on here?
Well, look, the problem is that there are very good reasons for getting out, but there are also some reasons why getting out precipitously would be very dangerous as well. So it all depends on how you get out. Ideally, you'd want to be able to leave with some kind of stabilization, which you obtained because you had some political arrangement with the insurgents. That is some kind of peace arrangement, sharing of power, whatever it would take, so that U.S. forces could leave without a complete collapse of the Afghan military. And what would follow from that would not be a Taliban takeover, but a very bloody civil war. So stability here is an important factor here. Obviously, there are very strong reasons for leaving, considering the fact that we don't really see a clear way forward at this point. And the American public would not, I think, tolerate very long if they thought this was an indefinite commitment, even with a small number of forces compared to what were there 5 years ago. So as I said before, it's a matter of it's lousy to stay. It's, if not done carefully, lousy to leave at this point as well.
So how do you, not you personally, how does someone determine either the right path in which to exit or the definition of success or failure? We've been there 17 years, and I wrote a piece shortly after we went in called Afghanistan, Where Empires Go to Die. And my point there was whether it's Alexander the Great, that what makes George Bush think that he's smarter than Alexander the Great, all you're doing is replacing war elephants with F-16 jet fighters. But at the end of the day, you're battling an enemy in a region that for centuries has been engaged in conflict. And what makes us think we can go in there and tell these people what to do?
Well, I'm very leery of making these kinds of historical comparisons. I understand where you're coming from with this.
Okay.
But this is not the Afghanistan of 3,000 years ago. This is indeed even the Afghanistan of say, 20 years ago. What has happened over the last 17 years, and there's a lot here that has grossly disappointed us, there has emerged in the country human capital. That is, as beyond anything, and I lived in Afghanistan 45 years, it's going back 45 years ago.
Okay.
There's nothing quite like what there is now in terms of the presence of educated, motivated, younger generation, and the population is full of young people because there's been a real upsurge in birth rate. These people have invested in this country.
Mm-hmm.
They would probably, if the Taliban were to score a victory, they would become again refugees. And I'm talking about here probably as many as 5 million people. So there is an investment here. We do owe something to them and the others as well. When we came in 2001, and I was there shortly after, we were welcomed at least for 4 or 5 years unconditionally. Why? Because under the Taliban, and I was there when the Taliban had taken over Kabul shortly after, so I saw that as well. What had been there under the Taliban, and one third of the country was out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
They were in exile, and mostly in Pakistan and Iran. What they had there was no economy that wasn't supported entirely by international organizations. They were very good at fighting and praying, but these people that I'm talking about would have no place there. So we owe them something after all these years because we helped create a country which is not functioning as we would have liked to seen it. But it would be a poor country in any case. This will always be a dependent country. It can't stand on its own. It doesn't have the resources. But what it does have now, and it's really impressive to see these younger people, and too many of them unemployed, but really wanting to see something in way of improvement in their lives. They haven't gotten it with this government. And for the most part, very few think that they're going to get it from the Taliban. What they do think that they might get from the Taliban is perhaps a less corrupt government. And that's not unimportant. And if it comes down to, as it did back in the 90s, if it comes down to choosing one thing over everything else, it is security. It's just that people don't want to be in harm's way.
The primary thing that people look for from their government is security and, well, slash stability. So about 14,000 American troops are there now. I think Trump, the numbers I looked at, Trump has added about 4,000 plus some 26,000
Right, and it's come up to between 14,000, 14,500, yes.
Right, okay. Plus some 26,000 American military contractors. Instead of Trump imposing a fundamentally different approach that he ran on, is he basically repeating the mistakes that the Obama administration made?
Well, he's inherited this. Look, when he came in, his inclination, not that he had thought through this or not, but it became part of his campaign. When he came in, he talked about, well, this war is a mess, and I'm going to get us out of it, making kind of campaign promises.
Sure.
When he got in there, his general said to him, look, if we take these 14 out, the security forces will collapse. Nobody can pay their salaries except us. And it's more than that. Their sense of their own security, really, even with 14,000, which is, you know, a very small number when you think about it, they've got on paper at least 350,000 security forces, if you include the police and as well as the regular military. Actually, the number is quite a bit lower in reality. But it's just the fact that there is an international commitment. If the U.S. leaves, the international community will not find it likely useful to stay. And then, as I say, we'll have that kind of collapse. Look, we're there now. essentially to buy them time. If you want to know what we're doing now.
Well, that was my, well, in fact, let me, because we just have a couple minutes left. So let me ask this question. Why are we still there? But more importantly to me, whose interests are we actually trying to serve? Are we taking into account what their culture, what their people, what they are actually trying to implement? Or are we trying to do what America seems to do in so many other instances, impose its will on a particular country, culture, and people?
Well, look, I think we can't sell them short. What they want is a responsible government. They want an accountable government. They want a government that can deliver basic services above all, and that is security. And in the last analysis, they'll take any government. If they have nothing else, it will be security. As I say, we're there to buy this government time, and I wouldn't put any money on it, but that's all we can say for at this point. We're buying them time so that they can put their act together, so that they can begin to provide jobs and security and a better justice system and reconcile among themselves, because the leadership itself is at one another's throats so much of the time lately. So we find ourselves at best just being hopeful about the future. And we've now stacked everything on getting a quick deal with the Taliban. The Taliban don't want a deal. And this is the problem.
Do they feel the need to deal?
No, they don't, because they feel that they're winning. And they also...
Well, let me just quickly ask, weren't they the ones that said, America has the watches, but we have the time?
And that's absolutely right. The one thing they have is patience. So what I'm saying is that, and this has to be understood, the Taliban at this point do not want elections and political parties and parliaments. The Taliban, and that doesn't necessarily represent the culture of the country, because actually the culture of Islam, of traditional Afghanistan, rather, that culture is far different than the culture of the Taliban. They're called Deobandis, whereas the majority of Afghans are Sufis. It's a much more relaxed version of Islam. And so it's the problem now is the Taliban don't want a deal. If they did, I think we would give them just about anything just to get out. But they're saying, no, we don't want your kind of political system. We want an Islamic emirate. And that's what we want. It has an emir, and we might settle for some kind of interim government, but ultimately that's what God wills, and that's what we want to take.
Are there other countries that are weighing in here, trying to keep the United States bogged down in a trench warfare, so to speak? So, you know, China, Iran, are there other countries that are fanning the flames here to keep the United States locked into this battle?
No, I don't think so. I think the countries around the region, Iran, Russia, Pakistan, all the rest, do not want to see the United States to leave and the place collapse. On the other hand, they feel very strongly they don't want the U.S. presence there over the long term. Now, I say these other countries don't advertise that, but what they say is leave, but don't leave the place in chaos.
That's a tall order. especially since it from my outside looking in, again, I go back to whose culture is controlling the narrative, or whose culture is controlling the objective? And is that a fair question to ask?
Well, it's not the culture. I don't think it's the strongest driver here. It has to be taken into consideration. You have to adapt, obviously, your institutions to the culture. But that culture has changed. You know, it used to be the culture of the tribe. Tribes are a factor still in the Pashtun area of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the country is urban now. The the real heart of the country really is in its urban areas. And they've come to a different set of expectations than they had years ago, 10, 20, 30 years ago, or historically speaking, when they were afraid of government. Today, what they want is government that will deliver for them, that will do things for them, because they have seen that many of them, because they were refugees, they've seen that government can also provide for them.
Gotcha.
And so that's a big change from the past when they ran away from anything which smacked of government.
Let me stop you there, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from 1999 to 2003. Sir, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate you coming to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Enjoy talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Google employees push to stop Project Dragonfly. More than 90 Google employees have joined a petition protesting the company's plans to build a search engine that complies with China's online censorship regime. This is an issue that's been brewing for some time. What is Project Dragonfly, and why are some Google employees so disturbed by this application? Well, for insight into this and other related issues, we're going to turn to my next guest. He's a web developer, technologist, and commentator, Chris Garafa. Chris, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, as always, a pleasure to be on with you.
Thank you, sir. From my recollection, this has been brewing since July or August. Let's start with, what is Project Dragonfly, and why are Google employees in an uproar?
Well, Project Dragonfly is a potential project, a search engine that Google may be developing for the Chinese government that would reportedly have some sort of censorship built in. So we do know that in China, some social media is censored and some search can be censored, right? And the outrage here is that Google, which is ostensibly, you know, an American company, but really has a position, you know, positions and offices all over the world, could be, you know, building a censoring search engine for China. Now, there are over 90 employees. It started out as just a handful. In the last day, there have been 90 employees that have signed on to this list. And as you said, we first found out about this idea from Google back in June or July. And there has been, you know, some opposition to it. But, you know, I have a number of questions. I have the letter here in front of me. It says, we are Google employees. Google must drop Dragonfly. So it says that they are working with Amnesty International and calling on the company to cancel that project. But here's my kind of my concern and where I'm looking at this in a different perspective. They say, quote, our opposition to Dragonfly is not about China. We object to technologies that aid the powerful in oppressing the vulnerable wherever they may be. That's a direct quote from the letter, but they spend the entire about 400 words talking specifically about China. And they cite things like the supposed oppression of Uyghur people, which has been actually proven to be a blatant falsehood and at the best, a misreading of a UN report from a couple months ago. So I'm wondering about the timing of this in the greater geopolitical and economic sphere, why this is happening now.
Today's petition, and again, there was a petition from Amnesty International as well as this letter from Google employees. It's the first time, as I understand it, that workers have actually used their names in a public document relating to company activities. So at a certain level, they could be really putting themselves on the line here. If Google were to find this activity to be contrary to Google's interests.
Yes, and there are many, looking at the list, there are many, many well-respected engineers, primarily software and site engineers on this list, as well as many other folks at Google. I'm looking through this, and I recognize many names, and they do fantastic work at that company and in our industry. I think the other time that people would have been identified is a few weeks ago when thousands of Google employees walked out of their jobs. And they did that in almost everywhere that Google has an office. It was something like 60 or 70% of Google offices. Employees walked out of their jobs to protest Google's handling of sexual harassment cases. And we should say they won a significant victory last week in that. One of the demands of that walkout was that Google needs to end forced arbitration when it comes to sexual harassment claims. And Google and then Facebook announced that they were going to do that. So this is the first time they're on a letter, absolutely. But folks were definitely on camera during those walkouts, too. And, you know, I will say overall, it is exciting to see these employees standing up and getting more political. Again, I have questions about the timing of this letter in the global political, you know, the geopolitical context.
Sure. And in the larger geopolitical context that you referenced, and the Uyghur issue, I find it interesting that Amnesty International has signed on to this, understanding the content of that letter. And if anybody would understand the veracity of the claim against China, I would think it would be Amnesty International.
You'd think. But, you know, Amnesty International, I have respect. They do a lot of good work. They talk about, you know, Guantanamo Bay, and they talk about the prison industrial complex in the United States. But at the same time, when it comes to international issues, Amnesty International often falls right in line with U.S. imperialism. They have done this in cases like Sudan, Iran. They do it with China. They do it with Syria, where they basically have no understanding of what imperialism is and no understanding of what the results would be of, for example, when they called for a intervention in Sudan. By the United States and ultimately the UN about a decade ago.
That's correct. Do you see any correlation or connection between what the Google employees are protesting here, what's been going on with Facebook, and the broader concern of personal security as it relates to the web, as it relates to social networks? Do you think that there could be an underlying current here with the Google employees that if you're doing these things for the Chinese government, and one of the things that I read about Project Dragonfly was a concern that if people in China were using the web or using Google to search on prohibited content, that that content would be linked, those searches would be linked back to the personal phone numbers of those individuals. So do you see that there could be some concern that what they're doing for China could tomorrow be employed in the United States?
Tomorrow? It's been deployed yesterday. and really, that's the thing, right? You know, and I'm sure these Google employees are aware of what their company is doing in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We have known, thanks to Edward Snowden, and WikiLeaks, right? We have known that Google has partnered with the NSA since 2009 in their prison program, right? So that's already getting them access to our emails, our search results, our browsing history, our physical location history, even among the many other things that Google knows about us. And it's not just Google; it's an industry-wide thing. It is Facebook, it's YouTube, which is now owned by Google but entered prison separately. It's Apple and Microsoft and AOL and
Amazon.
Amazon, which goes above and beyond for the government by building tools to help Customs and Border Patrol.
I was kind of setting you up with that question because I wanted to get to the Amazon point and the links between Amazon and defense contractors and the broader discussion about how what we initially thought, not you because you're a developer, so I'm sure you saw this coming, but the average citizen who said, a social networking app, how cool, let me talk to my friends, not understanding the nefarious implications and how deep this now has gone into eroding personal security.
Oh, absolutely. Whether it's Amazon, you think you're just buying stuff, but really they're tracking everything you do and search for. Google, they're tracking everything. And really, Google has become the provider of news. And if we want to talk about censorship and Google enabling censorship, then we should talk about the fact that Google already is a censoring search engine. News outlets like, you know, Sputnik and RT tend to appear lower in search results than they organically should. Now, that censorship isn't because of an outright law in the U.S., but it's because Google is playing its part as a partner of the government and as a gatekeeper to information for so many people in this country. Now, I was also, I actually talked to somebody earlier at Sputnik. We were talking about Android, Google's phone system, right? There is a letter that has come out also today from a transatlantic consumer dialogue group, and it's calling for the FTC in the U.S. to investigate Google for its practices of tracking users' locations and making it very, very difficult and confusing to actually turn that tracking off. So this isn't about China. This is about Google and its data collection all over the place.
Explain what you mean when you say that RT and Sputnik fall lower on search engines than they organically should. When you use the word organic, explain that, please.
Sure. So Google and all the other search engines have an algorithm, right, a formula to figure out when you type a search term in, what's going to come up as the result? What's the best result for your search? It has been shown that especially since 2016, especially since the allegations of Russian, supposed interference into the elections, not just Google, but Facebook and Twitter as well have been removing or, lowering the view rate of hits from Russian media outlets. So they've adjusted their algorithm. Effectively, they've adjusted the calculations to figure out what's most accurate to demote Russian news outlets and some others in the results. They're not doing that because they're less applicable to your search. They're doing that because they're supposedly, fake news or propaganda.
And let me say, I've done work at RT for a while, and I am here at Sputnik, and I can tell the audience I am always amazed at the quality of the research and of the reporting that takes place at both entities, and much, much better than domestic outlets. Let me just throw that out there. And I'll put that one up against anybody that wants to debate that with me. Now, Google has for a very long time been working on establishing a larger presence in China, and which is one of the, of course, we know, the second largest economy and the fastest growing. And in their letter, the employees said that they can no longer believe that Google is, quote, a company willing to place its values over profits. So now the Google employees say that they're, bumping up against capitalism versus altruism or looking out for the better good, the good corporate citizen. And so, A, as Google employees, what do you think they can do? And then more importantly, as consumers, has this thing gone so far down the track that is the cat out the bag and is the horse out the barn and there's absolutely nothing that consumers can do?
Well, I have to actually question this because they talk about placing its values above its profits, but Google as a corporation, as a company in a capitalist system, what other values could they have? They're legally beholden to make profit for their shareholders, right?
Mm-hmm.
So their motto used to be, don't be evil. They dropped that motto a few years ago. Now their motto is, do the right thing. So what is the right thing to them?
That's a Spike Lee movie.
Well, there we go.
And a very good movie, by the way.
A very good movie. Now, if you walk into Google headquarters and they're playing that on the lobby, I'm good with that. But I don't think that's the case. I think what they're saying is the right thing for who, though? The right thing for the shareholders and the right thing for their users and their employees are entirely different things.
And you know what? I'm sorry, Chris. Let me jump in there just real quick. I'm glad that you brought that up because to the minds of many people, that could be just an innocuous shift, but that's a subtlety that is incredibly important. If you're talking about corporate mindset, which impacts and leads corporate direction and corporate decision-making, That is a very subtle, I mean, some marketing folks, I think, spend an awful lot of time and an awful lot of money coming up with that for a reason.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when they had "Don't be evil" as a, you know, as a motto, I mean, well, what is evil anyway? What is evil to them versus what is evil to me or you? But it was a very specific change that they made. And yes, I'm sure they spent millions of dollars testing that in, you know, focus groups and whatnot, and developing it. But I want to go back to a question you asked about what Google employees can do to win these various campaigns that they're waging against their company. They have won in the past. So I mentioned earlier the walkouts, right?
Right.
And they won that. But they also, there was this, you know, earlier this year, back in February to March or April, right, Google employees found out about this thing called Project Maven. And they protested it. It was a Project Maven was a proposed partnership with the Department of Defense where Google would build better artificial intelligence for drones. Now, they say it would have started out with unarmed drones. Right. But there was nothing to say that the data from the drones wouldn't have led to bombings or that the technology they developed wouldn't have been applied to armed drones in the future. And so Google employees wrote petitions and they got public support and the company was actually forced to cancel Project Maven. And that cost them a lot of money. They were not, the company was not happy, but they made a decision based on the public outcry that it would be worse for them to continue working with the Pentagon in this case, to develop this system to interpret. Basically what they would have done is interpreted video imaging that could then have been used to improve the targeting, they said, of drone strikes. But 3,100 people signed a letter inside Google, 3,100 employees, and then there was mass public outrage and it started getting covered all over the media. And like I said, Google did cancel that project finally.
And just so those who may be wondering about drones and armed drones and drone strikes, they are nowhere near as surgical or as antiseptic as we are led to believe. There are an awful lot of innocent civilians that get maimed and killed in the course of these so-called surgical drone strikes, not to mention just flat out missing targets and targeting the wrong group. So going forward here real quick, we've got about 2 minutes to wrap this up. So I like the fact that you've very clearly pointed out what employees can do. Hopefully citizens will understand in other companies and dealing with other issues that there still is some value to we the people. But going forward, what do you see coming out of this, or what do you project for the near future with all of this?
You know, I see a growing movement in technology. Where people are standing up for their First Amendment rights, their Fourth Amendment rights, and human rights, basically. This is happening in San Francisco. It's happening in Silicon Valley. And actually, this movement is spreading across the country where workers in tech, which has traditionally been a very, solitary field, and it also has been a very white male-dominated field, and that's thankfully changing very much. People are getting together and saying that if we band together, we actually can have change. In a way, it's almost like the labor movement overall. If people get together, they can make change, and overall, that is a positive thing. You know, in this case, with this China project, I would encourage them to think about the reasons behind this opposition and the support of Amnesty International for this in terms of, U.S. imperialism and the geopolitical situation. But, overall, I applaud the fact that people at Google, at Amazon, at Facebook and others are speaking up and speaking out.
Chris Garaffa, web developer, technologist and commentator. As always, Chris, thanks so much for coming to The Critical Hour.
Hey, thank you.
You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.